This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. If you're a baby boomer, you might remember the 1950s TV series The Adventures of Rin Tin Tin, about a German shepherd and a boy named Rusty who lived with a cavalry troop in the American West. In 1954, Rin Tin Tin was such a star, he was interviewed by a writer for The New Yorker, who noted that the dog turned up his nose at roast beef and drank milk from a champagne glass. What many of us didn't know, and what our guest, writer Susan Orlean, points out, is that Rin Tin Tin, the TV star, was a reincarnation of an even bigger movie star who had dominated the silent screen in the 1920s and nearly won an Oscar for Best Actor. That Rin Tin Tin was played by a dog rescued from a World War I battlefield by Lee Duncan, an American doughboy who devoted his life to training and promoting that dog and others that carried on the legacy of Rin Tin Tin. Orlean's new book is about the Rin Tin Tin story and Americans' evolving relationship with dogs in the 20th century. Susan Orlean is a staff writer for The New Yorker who has written 7 books, including The Orchid Thief, which was made into the film adaptation. Her new book is called Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. Susan Orlean spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Susan Orlean, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, people of our generation think of when they hear the name Rin Tin Tin, they think of the TV show of the 50s, probably most of us. But what we learned from you is that in the 1920s, the original Rin Tin Tin was a silent movie star. How big was he?
His fame in the 1920s might have even been greater than his fame in the 1950s, which is considerable. Part of that is because the impact of movies was so enormous. But he was also a superstar. He literally and figuratively leaped off the screen. These movies were greeted as events. People of all ages went to the movies. They were shown all over the world. And it wasn't a minor statement to say that he saved Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers was a small studio at the time that they began making Rin Tin Tin films. Not only did he make them a major studio, but every time they found themselves in any sort of financial straits, they would release a Rin Tin Tin film, and it would set things straight. He was known around the Warner Brothers lot as the mortgage lifter for that reason.
Now, he made more than 20 silent pictures, and he was the star, right? I mean, what were the plots like? How was he depicted?
Well, it was really interesting to me because, first of all, of those 27 films, we only have 7. Unfortunately, you know, most silent films were not archived very carefully. Some of them were actually chopped up and melted and made into plastic. And we've just lost a huge amount of that. Apparently about 50% of all silent films have been lost. And more than that number of Rin Tin Tin's films were lost. But we do know the plots of the ones that exist and some of those that are gone. What was interesting is he was always the hero, but he always saved the day. But he didn't do it with the snap of a finger. There was always a struggle. He was the star. And he was in these films with the big silent film actors of the time. And yet, his was the name that was above the title. He was the big draw, even when he was in a movie with June Marlowe or Charles Farrell or Jason Robards. Rin Tin Tin was the leading man.
And there would be real character development, right? Rin Tin Tin might have been accused of a crime, like killing sheep, and then his master might doubt him and even consider doing away with him, and then both he and the master have to struggle with their relationship. And you know, we should say that this was a time when he wasn't the only animal prominently featured in silent films. You're right, there was this other dog, Strongheart, which was also a big draw. Why were animals more prominently featured in silent films than they later were in talkies?
They were actually, not only was Strongheart making films and a huge box office draw at the time, but nearly 80 other German Shepherds were starring in films in the 20s, which is just a staggering fact and something that really astonished me. I mean, how can – and they were the leading actors in those films. Moreover, dogs look much more natural not talking than people do. When you see some of these films, the people are – there's a quality in a silent film that's a bit ridiculous because we know people can talk. And yet, there they are, either pantomiming or using exaggerated gestures to make their point and then having the inner title card flash up and explain to us what they've just said. A dog is just doing what they do naturally, and they never look diminished the way people sometimes can. So they were the perfect silent hero. They just suited the medium absolutely perfectly.
Well, tell us about the first Academy Awards.
You know, this was a case where, I mean, this dog was beloved. People loved watching him on film and believed that he was an extraordinary actor. And the story has it that he was in line to get the first Best Actor Award. It was the first year that the Oscars were being given out. And it wouldn't have even been unheard of. I mean, he was a huge box office star. It wasn't a crazy idea. He was that popular and he was that seriously regarded as an actor. But the Academy, according to the story, believed that this new idea of handing out these Oscars could possibly be damaged by the idea of the first Best Actor being a dog, even though everyone loved Rin Tin Tin. And he was welcomed in the Warner Brothers commissary. He was treated not as a dog, but as a star. But the rules were written and or revised to say that no non-human could receive an Oscar. And lo and behold, Rin Tin Tin was robbed.
All right. Now, what about the stories that, like other temperamental stars, he could be, well, not exactly a sweetheart on the set?
Well, those I happen to think are true. I think it was often said that he bit a lot of his co-stars, and I'm not sure that he actually drew blood, but he was a one-man dog. He was bonded entirely to Lee. Lee never let anyone else handle him. And he, you know, at the time, the idea of behind the breed, which was really a fairly recent breed developed in the 1890s, was that they should bond intensely with one person rather than being friendly to everybody. Lee just didn't let anyone else touch him. And in his journal, he talked about later about how he realized that that was perhaps extreme and that in subsequent generations of the Rin Tin Tin dogs, he was a little bit less possessive.
Did he snap at anybody
and
famous?
He bit Jack Warner. He bit and, you know, a lot of the various stuntmen who were used in the films and the fight scenes with Rin Tin Tin would complain about how vicious he was. When you see those scenes, they are pretty convincing. I mean, there was no question that Rin Tin Tin enjoyed filming those fight scenes. And I assume that those actors were wearing very heavily padded suits because you see his teeth sink into the coat sleeve of a lot of his co-stars. And it's highly convincing, which makes me think that he enjoyed nothing more than giving a good chomp on someone's arm.
So what happened to Rin Tin Tin when the silent movie era ended?
At the end of the silent film era, Warner Brothers terminated Lee's contract. They sent him a letter saying they were putting all of their attention as a company into this new medium of talking pictures. And everyone knows, as they said in the letter, that dogs don't talk. In silent film, dogs and people didn't talk. Dogs then were on the same level as people in film. As soon as people were starting to hear speech in film, they became fascinated by it. They were obsessed with the technology. The fact that dogs didn't speak made them seem so much less interesting in a movie when people were so fascinated by the new capacity to hear sound in film. So the 80 German Shepherds that were starring in movies during the 1920s basically all lost their jobs. And really, Rin Tin Tin is the only one among them who managed to sustain a little bit of a career. He started appearing in B films that were coming out during that time. So he was no longer with a major studio, but he was still making films, whereas most of those other dogs just vanished and perhaps retired to a comfortable house somewhere in the country.
I want to talk about Lee Duncan, the man who was Rin Tin Tin's trainer throughout, you know, so much of the life of the character. He got Rin Tin Tin as a soldier in World War I. Just tell us a little about his background, why he got into the Army.
Lee was born in the late 1890s in California. His mother was a young woman who had fallen in love with a man who proved to be not very reliable. And after she had a second kid, he abandoned her. She was really not able to take care of her kids very well, and she put them in an orphanage for what turned out to be 5 years. She was finally able to reclaim both Lee and his sister when her own circumstances were improved a little bit, and she moved to a huge ranch that her parents were managing. So Lee grew up on that ranch. He was a pretty lonely kid with no special ambition. The one thing he really wanted to do was to fly. And when World War I began and the opportunity to enlist presented itself, he did enlist, I think mostly imagining that he'd get a pilot's license out of it. Of course, he ended up in a horrific piece of history. He was stationed in France and was in a squadron that was really in the thick of the battle. His greatest affection had always been animals. So what he did when he had time and was on furlough and so forth was actually tour the countryside looking for a dog to bring back with him when the war was over.
Right, so tell us about how Lee Duncan found Rin Tin Tin.
Lee was stationed in the Meuse Valley in France, and he had been sent to examine a battlefield that the Germans had just been pushed out of, just to see if it would serve as a suitable landing strip for the Allies. When he got to the field, he noticed a building that had been hit by artillery, but he recognized that it was a kennel. He decided to just take a look and see what was left of this kennel. Inside, he found the bodies of a dozen or so dogs that had been killed by the shelling. At the last minute, he heard a whimpering in the back of the kennel, so he made his way through this array of dogs who had been killed and found a female who was alive and had just given birth. She had a litter of 5 puppies. He, being an animal lover, simply could not walk away, even though in the middle of a very intense period of World War I, having dogs would not be a very convenient thing. Moreover, not having a mother and newborn puppies, but he could not leave them. He wrangled them somehow into his vehicle and took them back to the barracks and decided to take care of them.
Dogs don't live forever. And in 1932, Rin Tin Tin dies. What was the impact on the entertainment world?
It was a huge event. It was on a scale that is hard for us to imagine now. When Rin Tin Tin died in 1932, radio programming around the country was interrupted with a news bulletin announcing his death. The next day, there was an hour-long radio program in his memory. Every major newspaper carried a significant obituary extolling his virtues and talking about the loss of Rin Tin Tin as a tragedy, as an irreplaceable figure in American and international culture. And I just think it was viewed as a loss that was insurmountable. A lot of movie theaters hung pictures of him in a lot of stores around the country. The shop owners had a picture of Rin Tin Tin in their window as a sort of memorial to him in his passing.
You know, most of the folks in my generation know of Rin Tin Tin from the TV series in the 50s, and you write about this. This was the big revival of the Rin Tin Tin career. What was Lee Duncan's situation in 1952 when TV was growing and this idea came up?
The early 50s were kind of a difficult period for him. During World War II, he had been very purposeful. He had been involved with the Army, helping them train the Canine Corps, and Rin Tin Tin was the U.S. Army's mascot during that period. So he felt very purposeful and was earning enough money to be comfortable. But when the war ended, he was a little bit lost. He made one movie right after the war, which starred Rin Tin Tin, called The Return of Rin Tin Tin. And then nothing was really happening. You know, dog movies were not the big deal that they had been in the 20s. He was very skeptical about television, which was a very new medium at the time. So he was casting around, and I'm not quite sure what he thought would happen. He was in some financial straits. In fact, at that point, he had had a sponsorship with Kennel Ration, and that's where he got his dog food for free. And Kennel Ration basically came to him and said, you know, you're not really doing enough right now to warrant us treating you as one of our sponsors, so we're going to cut off your dog food. And Lee's financial circumstances were tight enough that really mattered. To lose the free dog food really mattered. So he thought, I've got to do something. And obviously, the big excitement at the moment was television. So he finally opened himself up to the idea that maybe Rin Tin Tin's future would be in TV and not in film. And it turns out he was right.
I believe a stuntman brings this producer, Burt Leonard, to visit Lee Duncan, right?
Yes. And Burt had an idea. The minute he met Lee and saw the dog, he hatched a plan. He was a great storyteller, and he came up with this idea that Lee loved, which was to set the show in the late 1870s. It would star a boy and a dog who are the only survivors of an Indian raid and who are taken in by a cavalry troop in Arizona and live with them and have their adventures together. And Lee loved the idea. So did Screen Gems. And the next thing we knew, Rin Tin Tin was debuting on American television in the fall of 1954 and was an immediate, huge success. Once again, having the kind of acclaim that he had had in the 1920s, both in the U.S. and all over the world, because the show was broadcast internationally as well.
Right, and TV had this enormous reach, and there was merchandising, right? There were Ren 10-10 lunchboxes and thermoses.
There was Ren 10-10, practically everything you wanted was available in a Ren 10-10 branded version. And this was the early beginning of merchandising. You know, there was no merchandising before the 50s. Ren 10-10 was one of the early big licensors, and kids went crazy. There were Ren 10-10 products of just every sort, both identified with the dog and with the stars of the show, Rusty and Sergeant Rip Masters, who became huge stars in and of themselves.
When Ren 10-10 was a star in the 1920s, it was 20s. It was, at least we believe, this one dog doing the acting, doing the stunts, living the life. He was the star. What was the case in the TV world? Was it one dog? Was it several dogs?
It was several dogs. And, you know, it changed. Ren 10-10 in the 20s was a dog who became an actor and appeared in movies performing roles. In the 1950s, Ren 10-10 had become an idea. He was a character played by a multitude of dogs. It was generally three dogs who played the part. And there was every effort made to make it feel like it was one dog, but there were definitely three dogs who were used to shoot the show, and then a fourth dog who did most of the public appearances. But I think people believed it was one dog, and the dog who lived with Lee and his wife and daughter was, in a sense, the Ren 10-10.
Susan Orlean talking to Dave Davies. Her new book is Ren 10-10, The Life and the Legend. You'll find a longer version of her conversation with Dave Davies on our website, freshair.npr.org. Here's a song about Ren 10-10, sung by the actor James Brown. No, not that James Brown. He played Rip Master in the TV series The Adventures of Ren 10-10. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
So brave is Corporal Rusty, though he is just a boy.
Just a boy.
How true is Private Ren 10-10? They are the Army's pride and joy. Yo, ready. Pals through thick and thin. From all the tales of the West, we'll remember best
Corporal Rusty
and Private Ren 10-10. You're ready. Pals through thick and thin. From all the tales of the West, we'll remember best
Corporal Rusty
and Private Ren 10-10.
What do you do with a novel that has the audacity to suggest that Hitler is history's greatest optimist? Welcome to the absurdist worldview of Shalom Auslander. Auslander is a best-selling memoirist, short story writer, and regular contributor to the public radio program This American Life. His debut novel is called Hope, a Tragedy. Auslander said he set out to write a comic novel about genocide. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Years ago, when my daughter was a toddler, my husband and I were friendly with another couple who had a child the same age. The friendship came to an end when the wife of the couple let slip that her husband had dressed their daughter as JonBenet Ramsey for Halloween. "He has an offbeat sense of humor," the wife explained to me. "That's one way to look at it. Or else, as I thought, maybe hubby's humor wasn't funny at all, just perversely detached from the horrific death of an actual 6-year-old. I thought of that couple as I was reading the debut novel Hope, a Tragedy by Shalom Auslander, another guy with an offbeat sense of humor. except the difference is Auslander is funny, very funny. Consider the title of his memoir about growing up in a strict Orthodox household. He called it Foreskin's Lament. In Auslander's novel, a young man named Solomon Kugel relocates his family from the city to an old farmhouse in Stockton, New York. Kugel wants a fresh start, and Stockton is defiantly proud of being famous for nothing. But Kugel's attempt to escape the burdens of the past is doomed from the moment he starts tracing the source of a mysterious tapping transmitted through the heat vents of his house. Climbing to the attic, he discovers none other than a very old and very nasty Anne Frank. She's hiding up there working on her novel, which, she tells Kugel, has to sell at least as well as her blockbuster diary. "I'm out of matzah," Anne Frank growls. "I can't work without matzah." Oy. As he surely intended, Auslander opens up a whole big can of slimy moral and aesthetic dilemmas in Hope a Tragedy. Maybe plunking Anne Frank down in your novel, as by the way Philip Roth did in The Ghostwriter and later in Exit Ghost, is excusable if there's a big enough point and if your writing is strong enough to carry it off. Maybe artistically appropriating Anne Frank, herself a brilliantly observant artist of her own tragic predicament, is not as creepy as dressing your child up to look like a little girl who, like Frank, was murdered. And maybe I have a headache, because Auslander clearly wants to lampoon identity politics, as well as the acutely understandable Jewish sense of victimization, by sending up Anne Frank, also known as she says here, Miss Holocaust 1945. Auslander, of course, benefits from the identity politics he makes fun of. It's impossible to imagine a non-Jew writing this novel, even as it's tricky enough as a non-Jewish critic to review it. If I like the book, I'm insensitive. If I say it's in bad taste, I'm falling into the guiltily pious attitude toward Frank that Auslander ridicules. The quality of Auslander's writing is the easiest question to address. Hope, a Tragedy, is a caustic comic tour de force. As Kugel wrestles with his Anne Frank problem, he considers getting rid of her by playing Wagner or hiring another Holocaust survivor like Elie Wiesel to evict her. He also contends with other annoyances. Kugel's marriage is strained by the presence of his dying but resilient elderly mother, who has nursed delusions of being a Holocaust survivor herself. She even once claimed that a lampshade, clearly labeled Made in Taiwan, was Kugel's grandfather. Here's a riff on the consequences of that whopper. If the intended effect was to make Kugel fearful of people, it had in actuality something of an opposite result. He came to fear inanimate objects. If the lampshade could be his grandfather, was the sofa his cousin? Was the ottoman his aunt? Auslander has said in interviews that he wanted to write a funny book about genocide, and he succeeded. Whether or not you read it, however, will probably depend on whether you think some things and some people are just not funny, or whether you think that the immense consolations of art include finding laughter and ideas in some pretty grim places.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Hope, a Tragedy, by Shalom Auslander. Coming up...
I do so long to go through the crowded streets of your mighty London.
Actor Gary Oldman. He stars in the new film Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to the interview Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies recorded with actor Gary Oldman, star of the new film Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Raised in a working-class London neighborhood, Oldman did stage work and broke into movies in a big way when he was cast as Sid Vicious in the 1986 film Sid and Nancy. Since then, Gary Oldman has been in dozens of films. He played memorable villains in JFK, Air Force One, The Fifth Element, and Bram Stoker's Dracula. In 3 Harry Potter films, Oldman played the character Sirius Black. And in Christopher Nolan's Batman film trilogy, he played a courageous cop. The new film Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is based on the Cold War spy novel by author John le Carré. Oldman plays George Smiley, a veteran spy who comes out of retirement to try and uncover a Soviet mole who is embedded in the highest ranks of the British intelligence service. The George Smiley role was played by Alec Guinness in a highly regarded BBC series in 1979. Let's begin with a clip from the new movie version of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. In this scene, we hear Oldman playing the normally reserved Smiley, who's a little tipsy and is recalling an encounter years before with a notorious Russian agent codenamed Carla.
I met him once. Carla. In 55. Moscow Center was in pieces. Purge after purge. Half their agents were jumping ship and I traveled around signing them up. Hundreds of them. One of them was calling himself Gastman. He was on his way back to Russia, and we were pretty sure he was going to be executed. Plane had a 24-hour layover at Delhi, and that's how long I had to convince him to come over to us instead of going home to die.
Well, Gary Oldman, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's been a long time. It's great to have you back.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
When you were offered this role of playing George Smiley in Tinker Tailor, how did you react?
Well, of course, I knew the material. I had seen the television series when it was first shown in, I believe it was 79.
Right.
And that was my, I guess, my introduction to John le Carré's work through that series. So I was familiar with the material, but I was apprehensive because Guinness was really the face of Smiley, Sir Alec Guinness, and had made him so iconic and a very much beloved actor, part of the sort of British establishment of acting. And so it gave me pause for thought. I thought, they're awfully big shoes to walk in.
Right, and the producers clearly thought these were shoes that you could fill, given your accomplishments and reputation. Did you go back and watch the Alec Guinness portrayal again? I mean, was that a reference point, or maybe something you wanted to avoid?
No, I wanted to avoid the Guinness portrayal. I really thought that I would be contaminated by it. And I didn't want to do an impersonation. I mean, it was very much a sort of a reinterpretation, and so I just worked from the book and the script. And of course, we had access to John le Carré, which is very useful because he was not only is he the writer of the book, but he was a spy. So it was in terms of a sort of actors talk about research. You know, it was one stop shopping.
Can you tell us what you got from talking to John le Carré about? Did he have advice? Did he have ideas? Were there things you got from observing him?
Yes. I was looking for, really, a voice for Smiley. And then I met le Carré. So I nabbed some of the cadence in his voice, some of the inflections. And I guess you do, as an actor sometimes, you begin with an impersonation. But it all often an impersonation can often work as just a sort of a springboard. And he had a lot of fascinating things to say. I mean, he was 80 last year. It is like really hanging out with a 25-year-old. He has a memory. It's a mind like a steel trap. He's rather like a jukebox, really. I mean, I was a little apprehensive about meeting him because he is the sort of the great author, the great master, and this is his. One of his great books, and we met, and you'd ask him a question, and it was like pushing the buttons on a jukebox. You put the coin in, and then away he would go. So it was an interesting meeting.
You've done so many intense and very demonstrative characters over the years in your films, and the thing that's striking about this role is how quiet it is and how bland, in a way, George Smiley looks. And I'm wondering how you approach, you know, playing a lead, taking command of a scene, exerting authority when, you know, at least superficially, you're doing so little.
Well, he listens. He sees everything. And he hears everything. But there's action. The listening, in a way, is very active. It's not just with the ears, that it's a complete physical thing with Smiley. He's very, very restrained emotionally. He is the spy master. He is has been over his career a wonderful interrogator, and this is what makes him dangerous. He's the leopard in the foliage in the jungle. He's the one that you don't see coming, and his motivation is it's always from a sort of moral certainty. Makes him a very interesting and complex character to play.
We're speaking with actor Gary Oldman. He stars in the new film Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. I wanted to talk about the 1992 film Bram Stoker's Dracula, directed by Francis Ford Coppola. You had this amazing performance as Count Dracula. I thought we would hear just a bit of it, but could you first just give us the visual picture of the Count, what you look like? What it took to put that getup on?
Well, initially, it took 6 hours to sort of put him together. But I am about 300 years old. This is going back, actually, to the days of scleral lenses. And they were a lens that, obviously, from their name, covered the entire eye. And you could only wear them for about 15 minutes at a time. But they were glass. They were rather uncomfortable to wear, and invariably, when you're shooting, you wear them for half an hour. You never wear them for 15 minutes because people actually were shooting and people forget you have them in. And after about half an hour, your eye, the muscles around the eye, around the socket, start to reject it and they start to cramp. I sound like Boris Karloff. I sound like, this is the old days, you know, when we used to wear these old lenses. And, of course, now it's all the plastic. It's soft. But I'm not complaining. But the robe was heavy, and then I had this sort of big, enormous sort of grey wig on the top of my head. It was quite something. Yeah.
It was quite an effect. And I want to listen to a voice. This is a short clip of you in the film, and you're doing a scene here with Keanu Reeves. Let's listen.
I do so long to go through the crowded streets of your mighty London, to be in the midst of the whirl and the rush of humanity. To share its life, its changes, its death.
There. You, Count, are the owner of Carfax Abbey at Purfleet. Congratulations.
Your firm writes most highly of your talents. They say you are a man of good taste.
Ooh, that's our guest, Gary Oldman, so, scaring the willies out of you.
That's so camp.
it's funny now, or odd to hear. It's the first time I think I've ever heard the voice without the picture. Mm. And I worked with an opera singer. I lowered my voice almost an octave for the role.
And the accent, is that Transylvanian?
It is. You know what? It is Transylvanian. We found a girl who ended up actually being one of the brides of in the movie. She was from Transylvania.
And so you listened to her speak and you picked up the accent and the rhythm?
Yeah. I listened to various tapes and things. And I made it a little of my own, and occasionally I would put in a little homage to Bela.
To Bela Lugosi,
right.
But it's so breathy and creepy, gosh. I want to play one more villain that you played. This is from the film True Romance, written by Quentin Tarantino, directed by Tony Scott, where you are a pimp. And in this scene, Christian Slater, who wants to liberate one of your prostitutes, has come to confront you in your nightclub. Let's listen.
We have a seat, boy. We have your sofa egg roll. We got everything here from a little eye Joe to damn as I know.
No thanks.
No thanks? What that mean? I think you're too scared to be eating. Let's see. We're sitting down here, ready to negotiate. You've already given up your I'm still a mystery to you. But I know exactly where your white ass is coming from. See, if I ask if you want some dinner, and you grab the egg roll and start to try down, I say to myself, this motherfucker, he's carrying on like he ain't got a care in the world, and who knows? Maybe he don't.
And that really is Gary Oldman, our guest. These voices are just remarkable. But, you know, it's not just the accents and the rhythm. It's the timbre of your voice. I mean, your George Smiley is different from the voice that I'm hearing right now. I mean, the pimp I just heard is not recognizable. Do you develop these things yourself, or have the directors said, this is what I want? Or do they just know, Oldman and he'll give you a terrific villain?
True Romance, for example. I met Tony Scott, and he sat me down, and he said, look, he said, I can't pitch the story, in the plot. He said, I'm no good at that. He said, but here's what I want you to do. Here's a character. He's called Drexel. He's a white guy who thinks he's black, and he's a pimp. And I said, I'll do it. It's Tarantino. I hadn't read the script, but I said, I'll do it. Sounds fantastic. And then I was filming a picture called Romeo's Bleeding in New York. And we were in the Bronx, I think, night shooting. And I heard a group of guys outside on the street. And I heard a voice, and I thought, oh, that's it. That could be the voice for Drexel. And so I grabbed the guy, and he came into the trailer. And I showed him the script, and I said, listen, is there anything that is insincere here? You know, would you say this? Would you say that? Am I phrasing that in the right way? And the guy who was an African-American who's from the street, you know, looked over the script, corrected a few things, and very kindly recorded some of his voice for me. And then I kind of based it on that.
I remember seeing you in the role of Dracula, Bram Stoker's Dracula, and that was 20 years ago. And I was so blown away by the performance. I still remember lines, and I remember thinking, who is this guy? And I looked and found out that it was Gary Oldman. But I didn't connect you with subsequent performances because you looked so completely different in many of these roles. I mean, you were in Air Force One. You were this crazy guy in the sci-fi film The Fifth Element. And I wonder if it might have impeded you building more of a popular fan base that people didn't connect you from one film to the next. Even actors knew who you were, but I wonder if some people in the public just didn't realize this is this remarkable guy doing all these different roles.
I mean, possibly. Possibly. I guess I've considered myself a character actor rather than, I'm not that sort of square-jawed 6'2" guy. You know, they don't really come to me for those roles, or certainly they don't knock on my door when they're looking for the lead in a romantic comedy. So
I bet you could pull it off.
I'd love to have a go. Yes, I mean, there's certain things that I've shied away from that have come in where I've said, you know, I'm not interested in playing that. Or someone else should play this. There are things that are not in my wheelhouse. Of course, you have to know your limitations.
Can you give us an example of something that in that category?
Well, let's put it this way. A film I did, I guess, about 10 years ago was a political piece with Joan Allen and Jeff Bridges, The Contender.
Right.
And I play the congressman, Shelley Runyon. I'm happy in the skin of Shelley, but I don't know if I could play the president. That needs, I feel, something else. And there may be people that would disagree with that and say, well, I think you could play the president, but I wouldn't want to wear those shoes. It'd be harder for me to do that, I think. Maybe less convincing.
So you've twice played presidential assassins, right? Air Force One.
I shoot
JFK.
Presidents. I don't play them.
Right, Lee Harvey Oswald, and then the crazed terrorist on Air Force One.
Yeah, yeah.
One more thing. When people recognize you on the street, are there certain roles they bring up or lines they speak to you?
People are extraordinary sometimes. Sometimes they can be quite heartless and not realize it. I was at a Q&A a couple of months ago, and the woman had sat through Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and then afterwards came up to me and said, "I love your socks." Oh, I liked the film, but I love your socks. Are they Paul Smith? Well, I'm glad you like my socks more than you like my George Smiley. But people are, on the whole, they're very kind, and they have favourites. There are the Sid and Nancy fans, who, for them, you have done nothing over the last 25 years.
Uh-huh.
You know, we like you as an actor, and we like this, we like that, but oh my God, we loved you in Sid and Nancy. So that's one that sort of haunts, that keeps coming back. They love the professional, but I can move around with a degree of anonymity. That's a good thing about being a character actor. I live a very normal life. I go everywhere. I do everything everybody else does, you know, and I'll go to the supermarket.
Well, Gary Oldman, it's been fun. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Gary Oldman speaking with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Oldman stars in the new film, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallant, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sherrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.